So here we are today. So thanks a lot, Tanya Lee, for accepting this interview with the Justice Spatiale, Spatial Justice, JSSJ, Journal for a particular issue that's going to come out in the coming months called Territories of Struggle and Spatial Justice. And since we had the occasion to meet a few months ago in Montpellier, with this workshop on injustices, the idea came to have an interview with you to have your for you to share your experience and knowledge and research works about what you've been doing in Indonesia. So as you know, I mean, the journal has looked into different forms of struggles and collective action and their territorial dimensions. And so I think this will really contrast with your extensive and long-term research experience in Indonesia in its rural areas, where you have actually found that collective action is quite rare and mostly ineffective. And this has been also starting point of our conversation for this interview. And so this has led you in your own work to write about injustices without recourse. So could you explain a bit more what you mean by this notion of injustices without recourse?
Hi, thanks for inviting me to this interview. I'm happy to speak about this subject. So, for me, this question of recourse is first of all an empirical one. Faced by injustice, the question that we could investigate is what then do people do? What can they do? What modes of recourse, what modes of redress are actually available to them? And, if you look around the world, you see that situations of injustice produce a wide range of actions, reactions, and also non-actions. So, thinking, that if you think about some of the possible courses of action, for example, recourse to the law, lobbying politicians, asking for the protection of the state, those are some kinds of recourse one might have, but I'll focus on the one that you're really highlighting in your special issue, which is collective action. So, one kind of recourse. If this could be collective action to demand redress from governing authorities, like appeal to the state through collective action. It could be also collective action to take over a space, take over an institution, or even take over the state itself in the sort of extreme form of a revolutionary movement. But these are some of the possible targets and aims of collective action. But when we look across the globe, we find that collective action of any of these kinds is actually exceptional. In most places, most of the time, people who suffer from injustice do not, in fact, mobilize collectively to contest it. So recognizing that, I think that we should be interested in collective action when it happens. But also equally or even more interested in the counterfactual, like non-mobilization, unheroic decades, places and periods in which people suffer from injustice but do not, in fact, organize collectively or rise up. So what does this mean, as a research agenda? Obviously, studying something that is not happening is more challenging than studying something that is happening. And readers, as well as researchers, love action, redemption, happy endings. So I think what this produces is a bias in scholarship towards one pole, a pole of attraction of the visible collective forms of action, especially action that scholars think of as progressive, at the expense of understanding the other stuff, right? The non-action, the lack of recourse, and the lack of collective mobilization. So that's, I guess, the provocation of the research that I've been doing, because it presents this problem empirically. People live with injustice and most of the time do not rise up. But I think there are many conditions under which that's the case that we could be interested in.
Good point. I mean, this contrast of non-action versus collective action. It also reminds me what can be said about, this biases in scholarship about, what's exceptional, scholars looking for what's exceptional versus what's, happening in the daily normal life that, becomes invisible. So in relation to, this, special issue, which is called Territories of Struggle and Spatial Justice, could you, because we like empirical stuff and fieldwork stuff. Could you give examples from your work about these concretely? What do you mean when you talk about injustices without recourse? And more specifically about, there eventually, if you can talk a bit more about the territorial and spatial dimensions about that.
Right. So I read the draft of your special, the introduction to a special issue, and I was really struck by a very important observation that you make, which is that collective mobilization most often occurs and is most often effective when it's in defense of territories. And you highlight the role of territory and space in enabling and orienting collective struggle. So I agree with you that this is really a crucial element in many struggles, having a space to defend. Drawing on my argument about counterfactuals, I think it helps to explain why, in the empirical case that I'm examining, collective mobilization is so rare or so unsuccessful. So, to get into the empirical case, the research I've done over the past few years, together with an Indonesian anthropologist, my colleague Pujo Semedi, concerns the expansion of corporate control over massive areas of the Indonesian countryside. Already, a third of all the agricultural area has been given in concessions to oil palm plantation corporations. So, this is a massive enclosure, a third of the agricultural land now under corporate control for just one crop. So, the injustice experienced by the local population is extreme. Their land, their forests, rivers, livelihoods, and living spaces are taken from them. They are squeezed into tiny hamlets stuck between the different plantation concessions, which go, one after the other, with tiny little spaces between them. I think of them as islands, little hamlets floating in a sea of palms. These spaces do not offer possibilities for autonomous farming because they're much too small. And socially, culturally, politically, they're not autonomous at all. Just like the plantations all around them, these spaces have been occupied by the plantation corporations. So village leaders work for the corporations, the community is fractured into pro and contra groups, and survival needs push people either to work for the plantation or to seek other small avenues to extract value, for example, through theft. So these spaces, these little spaces stuck between the plantations, they lack precisely the configuration that you have identified as essential for collective action. Autonomous spaces in which people can live, act, think, discuss, develop a critical vocabulary. So, in the plantation zones that I'm talking about, even memories of place and belonging are really obliterated. The fruit trees are gone, the graveyards are gone, the old hamlets are gone, the trails and the roads have gone, the rivers have been rerouted, and the stories which are embedded that in these places have also been destroyed by the bulldozers because plantations are a total radical transformation of the landscape. So, when the territory has been occupied by the corporation in such a brutal form, what I called in one of my essays, infrastructural violence. It's like the violence is built into the new infrastructure of plantation roads and the bulldozers and the rows of palms. So, in such an environment, it is really hard to see where to start, imaginatively, effectively, practically, economically, politically, how could you rebuild autonomous spaces in such a terrain? So that was that kind of understanding of the reorganization of space, the total reorganization of space, is what Pujo and I called in our book corporate occupation, being occupied by a corporation. In fact, not just one corporation, but a whole series of them back to back, one after the other, saturating all the spaces. So that's the spatial element of the you could say, the regime of power and control that's in place here. And it's lacking precisely, as I said, those autonomous spaces that are so crucial for collective action. Now, it's not quite total. There are a few examples in Indonesia, and they're much discussed by social movements, where people have mobilized collectively to reclaim plantation land. So when you look in detail, what were the conditions of possibility for this kind of reclaiming of territory? First of all, it turns out that the plantations involved were usually abandoned or in ruin. So the concession owners did not bother to mobilize the army and the police to try to defend, the plantation concession. So these were periods and places in which the normal forces which defend plantation space were not mobilized. And secondly, they occurred in rare moments of political opening in Indonesia when politicians saw some brief advantage in supporting a popular struggle. But in most of Indonesia, most of the time, these conditions do not, in fact, exist. So I'm not saying we abandon questions of collective action. I think we do need to study collective action when it occurs and try to understand its conditions of possibility, just as we need to understand its absence. So both help. One helps to explain the other, right? When you see when it occurs, you are not just assuming that it's the natural course of events that people would mobilize collectively. You're looking at, yeah, what enabled it to happen here and what's preventing it from happening there, right? Looking at both together really sheds light on the conditions of possibility and the kind of autonomy that action requires. And it's, as I've stressed, its spatial dimension.
I think, yeah, to really powerful insight to suggest to study the, the absence of collective action as well, especially when, referring to your, so, I mean, to your field work, we're basically, when we hear you and when we read you, basically, yeah, it's all about, this very dramatic situation of corporate occupation and, where, collective action is almost non-existing or, when it exists, it's really quite exceptional, under a number of conditions that need to be there. So this kind of leads me to the second question I have, which is also linked to a forthcoming issue you are writing with other co-authors on demands for justice and responses to social, spatial, and environmental injustice in the global south. So I think in that article, you or in the introduction of that special issue, you highlight the challenges posed for researchers studying communities who do not or cannot openly express their feelings of injustice for in a number of reasons. So that really raises the question of how can we actually study injustices in such situations where people facing harm have no space to express publicly their feelings of injustice and claims for redress.
Right. So, my answer to this question won't really surprise you. As you know, I'm an anthropologist, and our sort of mode of research involves relatively long-term field work. And I think in this case, it's really essential. I think the only way to understand feelings of injustice in contexts where they cannot be expressed publicly is through some kind of in-depth research that gets close to the everyday words and deeds and actions and reflections of the people concerned. And I think it's important to do this because, one conclusion one could draw would be, well, they're not, people are not rising up collectively to protest, so they must be satisfied with the status quo, right? Maybe they don't even feel there's any injustice. They think everything is fine as it is. And so, that's something to investigate. Like, do people actually consider this unjust? And what, if so, how do they characterize that injustice, and what do they say about it and think about it? So, people may not come out with the word injustice, But paying attention to language is definitely a place to start in that kind of inquiry. And in our research on plantations, Pujo and I noticed that one of the most common expressions villagers used to describe their predicament as they sat there in those tiny little landless enclaves was that they had become the audience. So in Indonesian, that's jadi penonton, right? Become an audience. So what is an audience? You know, an audience has no role in the drama. No one looks at them or even notices them. They watch what happens to other people on stage. So in this case, what they meant by saying we have become the audience is that they sat there on the sidelines watching plantation managers, well-paid workers, officials and politicians get rich from the plantation while they had no share in that wealth, but also no role to play. So becoming the audience, you know, we suggest is a vernacular expression of acute marginality, you know, invisibility, or what Jacques Rancière calls the part with no part, right? The people who have no part in the drama. And their predicament also conforms to the position that Agamben calls homo sacer, people who can be killed but not sacrificed, because the person whose sacrifice is recognized has a part in the drama. In fact, is the central figure in the drama. But neither the corporations nor the government in this case recognize that villagers whose land has been taken have made a sacrifice or have been sacrificed. They treat them as if they're simply not there, or if they are there, they have no value, hence they could not possibly have suffered a loss. So, you know, we argue that this idea of we've become the audience is a powerful and one could say compressed description of injustice, using an idiom that made sense to the people. This was the idiom that they used, that they chose. Another phrase heard sometimes is we've become like ghosts in our own land. Like, what is a ghost? You know, a ghost, you can't even see a ghost. You look right through them as if they're not there, right? They're sort of there, but not there, right? They have no part in the drama. It gets at a similar set of ideas. So that's the, you know, one way one could begin to understand experiences of injustice, which are not expressed in the language of injustice directly, but nevertheless indicate that people do not think that the status quo is a fair or reasonable one. The other kind of action, I mean, that was kind of words. How about actions? The main kind of action that we encountered in our ethnographic research was theft. Villagers and workers steal from the plantation corporation, and they also steal from each other. So we have to be careful of jumping too fast into a theorization a la James Scott of theft as a weapon of the weak, which sort of renders theft as something heroic. Theft, we were forced to recognize that theft can also be predatory. So we tried to pay close attention to how people actually described and evaluated theft. You know, is it a weapon? Is it a sin? Is it a sign of weakness? Is it a sign of strength? And so on. So all of this, you know, paying attention to words and deeds are the way that I think, you know, one can begin to get an understanding of how people experience the conditions of their lives, even without actually having an explicit political vocabulary in terms of justice and demands for justice.
How do you suggest we move beyond describing feelings of injustice or analyzing feelings of injustice? And what role can academics, researchers play in assessing what, you know, actually constitute an injustice as per se?
Right. So this is a question that we've really been thinking about in the volume that you mentioned, like together with other researchers here in Montpellier. We've been we're looking at this, trying to look comparatively at what we are calling demands for justice, experiences of injustice, demands for justice. And one of our starting points is not to impose a researcher's definition or even a kind of human rightsy kind of legalistic definition of justice, but to take off from what people themselves are experiencing, defining, and characterizing. So, attempting to do that. Now, it's not to say that it's not a question of looking for the autochthonous, because people form their ideas of what are just and unjust based on many resources, right? It could be because they listen to the radio. It could be because they've heard some politicians speak. It could be, people are engaged in a wider world. So it's not a question of just the local as if it has a distinct ontology or a separate notion of justice. But it just means being attentive to, what people do think of and describe as unjust in their circumstances. So, when people said to us, we've become the audience, it was their words, yes, but it was also our move to interpret that as a vernacular expression of injustice. So, yes, you listen to what people say and you try to contextualize it. Of course, in our case, it wasn't just one phrase, becoming the audience, but so many other ways in which people expressed their sense of being invisible, overlooked, discounted, not consulted. Injustices of recognition and procedure. These we were alert to these happening kind of every day. So assessing what constitutes injustice is again a matter of attentiveness. One prominent optic for thinking about injustice is of course justice of distribution. This question of the share, what anthropologist James Ferguson calls the rightful share. And so we were listening for this. We were trying to understand, what did people actually, did they have a concept of a rightful share? If becoming the audience meant that other people were getting rich and taking away the wealth, what was the share that they thought actually properly, rightfully should belong to them? And what we noticed is that it wasn't based on a claim for equality. So people sometimes conflate justice with equality. But in fact, in much of the world, inequality is something that we're quite accustomed to and often accept as normal. It's normal that a person like you should be richer than a person like me. I consider that normal. Perhaps you have more education or a different family, whatever. So inequality is often accepted as normal, and we distinguish inequality from injustice. Because injustice is where the state of affairs is, considered not normal and not fair, not reasonable. So what people described as a rightful share was to have a share of plantation wealth such that it wouldn't be 100-0. They felt that as things were, the corporation has everything, they have nothing. And they are treated as if they're not there, right? It's the audience again. So they wanted to be recognized as people who have a right to a share, which means we are here. We have always been here. This was our land. We recognize that you are here now and you have done things with this land and you have planted all this palm and generated all this wealth. But we need a sort of new deal, right? You need to recognize that we too have a right to a share. And then perhaps you would discuss what that share would be. But for them, I think that it was recognition that came first, right? Not just being treated as the audience, but being acknowledged as a participant in a process, in a dialogue, in an agreement, that was what they were seeking first and foremost. So, your question, what role can academics play? Well, maybe all we can do is attempt to be attentive to this, right? Not to come in with our judgments of what's fair or how things should be or what's unjust. But to be really attentive to the dynamics, what people are thinking, saying, claiming, what actually is the nature of their demands, and certainly not putting words into people's mouths, or even, in fact, even being disappointed. You know, some activists in Indonesia are disappointed that the people whose land has been taken by corporations are not demanding that the corporations be evicted. You know, this is what they should demand, right? They should demand their land back. People seldom actually demand that, probably partly because they can't even imagine that you could actually remove the occupying power. But what they are interested in and what they think might be possible would be to transform the occupier into some kind of a partner. You know, that would be that they would like, that would satisfy their sense of justice.
So now I guess I'm gonna change scale a bit, and because I've had the opportunity to have a preview of your forthcoming article about injustice without recourse. So, so it's basically this story about these communities that are affected by the expansion of the oil palm industries in their territories. And what struck me was that the international dimension of struggles and their relays was, seemed quite absent in this paper, despite the fact that, well, I mean, the palm oil value chains is highly global, and there has been, although it has been mainly on orangutans and an environmental issue, but there has been some, international media attention on palm oil. So, I just wanted to ask you the question about what you'd have to say about the different scales, of struggles and, recourses that are possible against these, this, corporate occupation, as you call it.
Right, yes. Well, so first of all, on the question of the global, Indonesians have been producing commodities for global markets for centuries. You know, think about the spice trade, collection of resins, forest products back in the old days, then smallholder crop booms for coffee, clothes, rubber, cocoa. So the global element of value chains is not new for Indonesia. And it's often, in fact, surprisingly, quite remote people who are most involved in these global value chains. Just think about it. If you're in the middle of nowhere, like way up a river or up a mountain, and you want to grow tomatoes for the local market, you're very quickly going to crash the local market for tomatoes, right? And then your tomatoes themselves will get destroyed on your way as you hike down the mountain or down the river. So, commodities for global markets like coffee, clove, cocoa, they're relatively dry, they're hard, you can store them, you can sell them. So, these are people who've long, long, long been connected to global markets. So, as far as I'm concerned, it's not the global market or the global element that's new. The crucial question from the perspective of justice is not where did the crops go, but how the profits are distributed along the value chain. And that's a matter of power and politics. So I think, highland and sort of upriver indigenous folks, peasants, involvement in global exports in Indonesia and, in fact, in much of Southeast Asia, it puts an interesting twist on Gibson Graham's notion of autonomous zones of counterpower. Because the goal of these commodity producers in Indonesian hinterland has not been autonomy from markets, which they usually regard as quite essential for improving their economic security and their well-being. Rather, the question for them is how to hold on to the value that's created. So, as far as I have understood, global campaigns against oil palm generally miss this dimension. The problem is not with oil palm as a crop or palm oil as a commodity, but with the highly extractive conditions which are imposed by plantation corporations. So when smallholders grow oil palm, which they do with great enthusiasm whenever they have land, they capture more of the value for themselves. And we noted in our research that they tend to pay their workers well as well. And they generate lively rural economies in which money circulates. People with money fix up their houses, start small businesses. So, involvement in this global commodity chain for oil palm, when smallholders are doing the producing, actually generates a lot of local wealth, not only for the growers themselves, but in the whole economy, because other non-farm work is also generated, right? Somebody's got a new business fixing up houses or putting on new roofs or fixing motorbikes, and there's enough money circulating that there can be little food stalls and so on. So you get a lively rural economy with a relatively good distribution of benefits. In contrast, when plantation corporations monopolize all the territory and grow oil palm, they create dead zones of impoverishment and despair, like the hamlets that we described, right? Squeezed among the palms, among the corporate palms, they have no land to grow palms or anything else themselves, and they are effectively destitute. So, same global crop, vastly different outcomes, right? So it's not to do with the global value chain or the crop. It has everything to do with the conditions under which it's grown. And most of Indonesia's oil palm, its palm oil, currently around 85%, is exported to India, so where it's used as an affordable cooking oil. So this is not a market in which global activism against palm oil or for sustainable palm oil has much traction. So although it's true there have been campaigns in Europe, less than 10% of Indonesia's palm oil comes to Europe. There's many markets elsewhere. So this type of global activism isn't actually going to have much traction in Indonesia. So I think from my point of view, that thinking about the scale, this question of the scale of justice, I do believe that a crucial scale is in fact national. And the problem is not with the crop, and it's not with its export markets. It's with a development policy in Indonesia that's given a third of the nation's farmland to plantation corporations and squeezing smallholders out. So that's a national development policy. And the relevance of the national scale becomes especially clear if you look at it comparatively. So in Thailand, which is the world's third largest palm oil producer, 80% of the crop is grown by smallholders with an average plot size of 4 hectares. So different nation, different national history, different land law, different rural development policies, and vastly different outcomes. So, same crop, Thai oil is also going into global markets, but the way that it is grown is dictated by national development policy, land policy. Is it a government which gives everything and every support and frankly every possible subsidy to corporations, or is it a national development policy which has faith in smallholders and supports them so that they can profit from this crop? Which is one that interests them greatly. So, scales of justice, right? The transnational, the global isn't necessarily the key. Yeah, I think in this case, the national is actually a much more pertinent domain. And of course, it's very difficult to change what's happening within Indonesia. And the global campaigns like the current EU regulation on deforestation is in a sense an attempt to govern at a distance, right? To exert pressure on the Indonesian government to change its policies via an EU regulation, action at a distance, and it's not going to work.